Hello and welcome to another episode of Everything is Canon, the CineLinks podcast, the podcast where we discuss the latest books and novels with the people who wrote them. I am your host, Steve Dunk, and however you may have found your way here, thanks so much for tuning in. If you like that intro music, then you've got great taste. That's Sam Witwer and the Crash Tones. If you want to hear more of the Crash Tones, you can download their latest album, Revenge of the Crash Tones, on iTunes or head over to samwitwer.com to hear more. Check it out. Today we're talking to multi-talented Kaylin Buran, author of the great new YA novel Cinderella is Dead. We discuss all sorts of things, including flipping a classic fairy tale on its head, creating a connected fairy tale universe, and writing a black story during these sensitive times. This is a spoiler discussion, so please, if you haven't read the book and don't wish to be spoiled, better stop listening now, but definitely double back after you've read the book.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. I'm very, very, very excited for this one today. We have such a great guest. Her book is, there's so much buzz about this book right now. And I was so happy to get a copy and read it. And I read it in one day. I couldn't put it down. And I'm like, I cannot wait to talk to this author. And I'm so happy she agreed to speak with us today. So please welcome to the show, Kaylin Buran. Hey, Kaylin.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Of course. The book I'm talking about is Cinderella is Dead. This book is buzzy right now. You must be feeling some of that. You have to be, right?
People keep letting me know and it just feels so surreal.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It's been out now a couple of days. Mm-hmm. People just seem to love it. Is that what you're getting? I mean, like, I don't even see any like lukewarm, right? Like,
yeah. It's kind of like in publishing, you kind of want to, you know, have realistic expectations. So I was like, okay, you know, maybe, you know, there's going to be people who aren't going to like it. And I'm kind of, you know, I'm preparing myself for that. And so the overwhelming kind of support for it and the enthusiasm for it has really been just a very pleasant surprise. So I'm extremely thankful and happy. And it's really surreal.
Yeah, you never know, right? I mean, you put something like this, you spend so much time writing it, and when it's done, you just have to let it go, and it's such an unknown and such a scary moment, right?
Yeah.
It's so personal to, you know, I've talked to so many authors, and it's so personal, and so many things can happen in the course of writing a book, right? Because it takes so long, and life changes, and I mean, look at what's happened the last few months.
Right.
Half a year now, it's unbelievable. Couldn't have predicted anything that was going on, but one of the great things, if there's a silver lining to be had at all, is that, you know, we've really been able to sort of like look at all these different people, get the spotlight shone on them a little bit more than maybe they wouldn't have, right? So
right,
and that's the thing that we got to learn from everything. If we take anything away from this, we have to understand that. And I'm grateful for it for sure, and it's certainly got me, you know, looking at different things. And I made the decision to change something in my life so I could actually help support more authors, black authors. So that's one of the great things that I've liked that's come from this movement. And is that something that you felt that, I don't want to call it a bump, but there's been there's been more attention being paid to authors of color for sure, right?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, there's this, and I'll just be completely honest, it feels it's kind of like a double-edged sword. Like, it feels great to have the support. It feels like, yes, we need this, you know, we need this support, and our stories deserve to be out there. But I don't, you know, but it also feels like they always have been, and we've always needed support. And so I'm glad that people are joining the conversation and that we're having these difficult, you know, it's kind of a reckoning, you know? And so I'm glad for those conversations, and I'm glad that people are paying attention more. I just, and then there's the part of me that feels like, well, why now? Why haven't, you know, because we've always been here, and we've always been, you know, creating, and you know, our work has been here. And so it's both, you know? And I'm a Libra, so I see both sides of, you know, I'm looking at things from both, you know, I'm weighing everything. And so, I'm trying to, you know, I'm trying to just kind of take things one day at a time, but I am glad that there's, you know, the spotlight. And I hope that it continues, because what I saw was, you know, an uptick in support for about 2 weeks, and then it kind of tapered off.
Right.
You know, I think that's something that needs to be addressed long term. How can we support, you know, Black authors and authors of color in the long term? So I'm glad that these conversations are happening.
And that's that. You just, you know, you couldn't have hit the nail on the head any better than that. Like, that's one of the things that, you know, and I'll just say me, you know, white dude, have to make sure that, you know, collectively we do continue this, like you said, longer than 2 weeks anyways.
Yeah.
Right. Like,
yeah.
Like, that's,
I need a little bit longer than 2 weeks.
That's pretty pathetic. That's pretty pathetic. It's one of those things where it's such a personal decision all of us have to make, right? Like,
yeah,
it's what, like you said, it's one thing to have fake outrage, but it's another thing to like put that into action. And that's one of the things I'm trying to do anyways. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to make some changes so that I can be in expand my circle and to talk to a wider variety of people, for sure.
Yeah.
And a wider variety of just, it's to my benefit, because I get to read this incredible book and talk to you. And so that's the serious stuff, but it's important.
Yeah. For sure. And it's important. Yeah.
It's so important that I totally agree. We got to keep it going. And that's what we're going to do. A couple of things, sort of reading on your bio. Kansas to Alaska to Texas.
Yeah, that only happens when you're like linked in with the military.
I kind of thought it was maybe something, because I moved around a lot as a kid too, but it just it was work related for my parents as well, not the military.
Yeah, so yeah, my parents were military, and now my partner's military, so it's kind of like, I was born in Kansas, but I was raised in Anchorage, Alaska, which is random. And, I grew up there, and then I met my partner there, and then we moved to Georgia. and then we moved to Colorado, and now we're in Texas. So yeah. Wow. So we're all over the place.
That's crazy. And it made me think of Sophia a little bit, and Constance as well. And they do so mm-hmm. much traveling in this book and in such a short period of time. And I have to think you've had some, your own personal experiences and adventures in that time that probably found their way into this book. Which we will definitely get into. One of the things, again, reading your bio that I really loved, and I'm just going to quote it because I couldn't say it any better. So you say, my hope is to provide an opportunity for readers to see themselves reflected in my work and take heart that they too can be the heroes of their own stories. Beautifully said. Seems fairly obvious what it means, but why don't you tell me what it means?
So for me, you know, personally, I just, you know, I loved to read as a kid. I loved fairy tales. I read anything I could get my hands on. And even still, even, you know, with not having any kind of restrictions placed on what I could read and, you know, age categories or whatever else, I just did not see myself, you know, I didn't see Black characters in fairy tales. And I really felt like I was missing out on something. I adore the Cinderella story. There's a lot of nostalgia connected to that story for me. But when I sat down and decided to write, a novel, I really just wanted to tell people like myself, like that younger version of myself, that you belong. There's a place for you. And it doesn't always have to be rooted in pain and suffering and, you know, the struggle. You can be, you know, a wizard, you can be a dragon tamer, you can be, you know, the chosen one. All of those things belong to us as well. And so I just want readers to feel like they are being seen. And I also, you know, I also really want readers who maybe don't share my characters, intersectional identities, I also want them to see us in these roles as the heroes, as, you know, the main characters, because that's important too. It's important to see people who, you know, who don't look like you take the lead in a story and be okay with that. So, everything that I do, I try to keep that younger version of myself kind of in the back of my mind, you know, what would she want? What would be good for her? And so that's what I tried to do with Cinderella. And that's what I'm trying to do with other books that I'm working on.
I am going to ask you about those other books because I'm curious. To your point, and one of the things that I thought was so well done in this book, which, by the way, I am no bullshit. I am just in love with it so much. And we'll get into why. But one of the things I liked, and to your point, you deliver that message, you know, sort of the idea of just being allowed to simply exist, but not in a, you know, in a finger pointing lesson, has to be a lesson learned type of way. You're just simply telling Sophia's story. And, you know, through her actions, through her interactions, through her relationships, you know, that's how you're sort of telling people it's okay to be who you are no matter what. I'm a like a cis white dummy. Like, I've never experienced any type of, you know, what I'm trying to say, you know what I mean?
Sure.
In my life, certainly. And I've certainly never felt underrepresented in any of the stuff that I grew up watching, reading, loving. Right. Mm-hmm. So in a lot of ways, and one of the things I read recently too, about, you know, Hamilton being, you know, the world's greatest or most popular piece of fan fiction. This is sort of fan fiction in a lot of ways, you know, in the sense that you read something that you were a fan of Cinderella, I assume.
Right. Yeah.
And, but again, just didn't see yourself, you know, in, there was no place for you in that film, right? In the original stories, which go back longer than the film, which some people don't even know.
Right.
So you took it upon yourself, and you've been writing fan fiction your whole life. So was that was the idea, right? I mean, you just wanted to tell a story, and people are going to glean from it what they will.
Yeah, that's definitely where it started. It really, because I love fan fiction. That's kind of how I, you know, started my writing kind of journey, just kind of wanting to see myself in stories. And so, you know, it's kind of easy in the beginning. Well, easy is subjective, but mm-hmm. you know, it's fun in the beginning to kind of, okay, let me take this story that I really adore and maybe just put myself in there, or put somebody that looks like me in there. So that's kind of how I started. But I think that I started from a place of just wanting to see more characters who kind of looked like me and felt like me. But then as the story, you know, writing kind of, it just kind of evolves as you're doing it. Sometimes things happen as you're, you know, while you're drafting that you didn't plan on or that you didn't expect. But the other aspect is this idea that stories kind of, especially fairy tales, kind of affect who we become. And we are exposed to them at such an early age. And I just kind of wanted to explore how that would affect someone who did not fit into the parameters of, you know, a fairy tale. You know, what if the main character is Black? And what if she doesn't want anything to do with finding a prince? You know, where does that leave her? What if she would rather find a princess, or what if she would rather find no one? You know, what if, you know, what does that look like for her? And so those questions, you know, came up very early on in the writing process. And so it ended up being a really good entry point into the story. You know, if we're looking at this story of Cinderella that's used as the backbone for the society, what happens if you don't want to find a prince? And what happens if you are in love with your best girlfriend? And, you know, what happens? And so that's kind of where I went with that.
A lot of it, and, you know, fan fiction in a way can be, it's sort of like revisionist history in a way, right? Mm-hmm. And these old Disney classics, these fairy tales, they've been around for so long, and they very, very much mirrored like the time in which they were made, right? In which they existed.
Right.
Like a lot of art, like all art does for the most part.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And because these are because they reflect society at the time when they're made, in a sense, they are history, a part of our history anyways, and because it's revisionist. So, in a very profound way and moving way, and you're changing history And that's going to, like, let's not pretend there aren't some people somewhere in the world in the United States who are going to, like, scoff at this and how dare you. And
oh yeah, they are my DMs. Yes. So yes, they are right. They're right here. Yeah.
Sure. And I'm sure they're full of wonderful things to say. I'm sure. All constructive things. I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, but is that something that, did it get that sort of intricate for you, or is it just, or you just simply really enjoy just telling a really great story and seeing yourself in that story?
I think it's a little bit of both, because yeah. I really do enjoy, you know, storytelling for me, and kind of the way that I, you know, have been exposed to fairy tales and mythology and things like that. It's very fluid. It's always changing. And especially when you have, you know, a tradition of oral storytelling, you know, the story's always changing a little bit. It's always a little different depending on who's telling it or when they're telling it. And so I feel like the nature of storytelling is to, you know, is to change and to evolve. And so I feel like, you know, this kind of reimagining of the Cinderella's story is just another kind of extension of that storytelling tradition. So I don't take to heart, you know, anything that racist people have to say, and they have a lot to say. Mm-hmm. But yeah, but I still see it and I still hear it and I still, you know, so I still kind of think about, you know, I still kind of think about those things, but it, you know, I think that what I'm doing, or what I'm trying to do at least, is much more important. It's just, you know, I just want people to have options. I just want kids to be able to have the option of picking up a retelling that, you know, has black girls, that has queer girls, that, you know, is, that just has, I just want you to have as many options as everyone else. Yeah.
A lot of it is a reflection. It's just their own fear and anxiety, right? Because you're right. Yeah. Things do evolve, things do change. And you know, our art has to reflect that. And I'm sorry, boys, but you know, it's just the way it is, right? Like, and I think fear is a big part of it. And in this book, in Marseille and the other towns, fear is such a huge theme in this book. You know, the control, manipulation, you know, keeping that fear alive and well, right? That's such a huge part of what goes on here. And you know, one of the things that this book, you know, scares me in the sense that this book very much appeals to like men's desire. Ultimately, I think this is maybe too Freudian, but to be in control, right? How you know, and I think about like how many men would actually resist if this, you know, this is very Handmaid's Tale in a lot of ways, right?
Right.
And, you know, I think about that and I think like, okay, let's say I was born in 1890 or some other old, ancient, stupid time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, would I be Luke or would I be Edward?
Right.
Would I be, right. You know, this is the kind of shit that keeps me up at night because I believe I'm a good person and I want to be a good person, but so much of us is nature, nurture, environment. I wonder, you know, if I was, you know, let's say this was a real time period that existed and you know, we were ruled by a King Manford, you know, like how would, you know, would I be the resistance or would I be the people that fall into line? Because it scares me that as men, I feel like somewhere deep inside of me, there is that little gene that I don't know. I don't know.
And that's something that, you know, I think I tried to kind of illustrate in this book, because I think we see it, you know, with Sophia's father. He loves her. Mm-hmm. He loves her more than anything, but he still allows her to be harmed by this oppressive system because he doesn't know any other way. He doesn't see, you know, any escape. He doesn't see any hope for the future of a young girl who will not conform. And so, and that's heartbreaking for Sophia. And it was tough to write because, she loves her father and she's asking him, you know, don't make me do this, please. And he's saying, I love you, but I can't. We have to do what has always been done. And so I think that, you know, making those kinds of structural changes, I think that's why, you know, sometimes it feels like you have to burn things to the ground and start over, because you can't build on this foundation of, you know, misogyny and homophobia and racism. It's like, you can't just build on top of that. You have to tear it down. You have to go down to the foundation and figure out, you know, how to fix it, from the bottom up.
Right. Well, it's, and again, very much, and I don't know if it was your goal or not, but it's so much of what's happening today, right? It's so ingrained. It's so systematic. It's so, they're so dug in, right? Their heels are so dug in. It does take this, it will take a revolution, right? It's going to take this massive thing. And that's what, you know, at first I think, and definitely please correct me if I'm wrong, but Sophia at first just wants to live her own life, be her own person without, you know, without fear or reprisal, but ends up being the leader of this revolution in a lot of, in a lot of ways. So she sort of is forced to change and realize, and with the help of my beautiful Constance.
Yes.
That's Erin Kellyman, right? Is that who you think of? That's who I thought of. Is that, you know what? We'll play a little fun fan casting at the end.
Yeah.
But it's got to be, I just saw Erin Kellyman as soon as you described the first, described her.
Yeah. But,
obviously the curly hair and freckles are, that's a no brainer, but.
But
thanks to our wonderful, beautiful Constance, Sophia starts to see things a little differently and understand that maybe she does have a bit of responsibility to these people as a human, right? As we all sort of do. I mean.
Yeah. And I think that she definitely starts off just trying to, like, how can I just live my life the way I want to live it, you know? But she realizes that even if she makes a change for herself, even if she, you know, escapes, there's still, you know, the seamstress is still there with her mm-hmm. son. The, you know, Erin is still there with, you know, her situation, and Liv's younger siblings are still there. And it's she realizes, you know, pretty quickly that she can't just think of herself. And, you know, I think sometimes that's, you know, that need to kind of have this self-preservation. You know, that's what drives us a lot of times, but it, you know, the bigger picture really is more important. Like, how do we, you know, how do we help everybody who's, you know, who's being oppressed? And, you know, we're not free until we're all free. So it, and I think Constance helps her kind of realize that. So yeah.
A lot of times, like, people are courageous when they have no other choice, right? And when I'm glad you brought up the seamstress, because that was the one scene, you know, where she's carted into the town square, and you know, she was resilient her whole life and suffered horrible abuse at her shitty husband. And, and, you know, has that great line, you know, about serving one purpose in her life. She would rather die than just let one more person suffer at the hands of the king. Great scene, great line. And that's sort of like, I don't know if that was like the watershed moment for Sophia. Her buttons have been pushed so many times, and that's really what this is, right? Like, she gets poked and poked and poked and poked until finally she can't take it anymore. But that was really important for her to see, because at that point she is looking at it from an outsider at that point.
Right.
And it's
yeah. And she's right on the cusp of kind of, you know, this life-changing, you know, shift in her perception of things and what kind of actionable steps she's going to take next. And so seeing what happens there is, and also having this kind of memory, you know, that she's seen something very similar before, it kind of sets in her mind that there will not be an end to this. and it won't stop with the seamstress or anybody else. It will just kind of continue on. And so she, it affects her deeply, and it's something that she continues to think about, you know, through the entirety of the story.
One of the things I love about this book, I'm a huge sap, so, you know, love is upfront and strong in this book for sure. And loving without conditions, right, is such mm-hmm. a huge part of this. And, you know, and Sophia doesn't really truly understand that fully until she meets Constance. But one of the things that, you know, not just love, romantic love, but familial love too. And one of the things I liked about Sophia's character was her relationship with her grandmother, which you don't explore a lot. You use it sparingly, but it seems to come up, right, sort of very important points. Yeah. It felt personal to me. Is there a little bit there with you in your own life, maybe? Did you have a grandmother who sort of inspired you to be a rebel?
Yeah, I mean, I have, you know, grandmothers and grandmother, you know, type figures in my life. And those, I just always find that, like, the older women in my life and also, you know, with other, you know, stories that I'm working on, those grandparents play a huge role because they've played a huge role in my life. So yeah, it's definitely personal, and it's definitely, you know, it feels, there's just something about, you know, when your grandma's like, you know, let's get to work, let's do this, I know who you are, you know what I mean? And kind of like, you're my dad's, you know, like, oh, we have to go do this. And my grandma's like, no, we're going to do something else. So, you know, it's, her grandmother is kind of the voice in her head who is kind of letting her know, and has always let her know in a very kind of subversive, subtle way that who she is okay. And she doesn't have to be anybody else. But that sometimes, you know, you will have to, at some point you will have to sacrifice in order to kind of get to the end point. And so that, you know, that end point that Sophia is hoping for. And I think, yeah, I mean, it's definitely personal for me.
It felt personal for sure. And one of the things too, that it just really just goes plays to the scene you set too, is that, like, I'm sure the grandmother had similar conversations with her father, Morgan. And, mm-hmm. but it was just lost on him, right? It was a wasted, but, you know,
yeah,
it probably meant for the women of the village, but, you know, just completely lost on. Even Morgan at one point says to Sophia, you know, I know you've always had this is paraphrasing, I'm going to screw it up, sure. But you know, I don't know where you get this fiery spirit from or however he says it, but, you know, he knows full well, he must know.
He does.
But he's just, yeah.
Yeah. He knows. And he's kind of hoping that if we just don't talk about it, and if we just kind of remind Sophia what happened to her grandmother, that maybe Sophia will take that and be like, okay, let me chill out. Let me, you know, let me kind of make myself small. But it has the opposite effect. It's more like, well, I can't live with what happened to her. I think about it all the time, and her words are kind of echoing in my head. So I have to do something else. I have to find another way. And so that, you know, I think that's kind of how it works sometimes. You know, it's like you're trying to use a scare tactic to influence a certain result, and the opposite ends up happening.
One thing that you do in this book is that you completely take the Cinderella tale and flip it on its head, and it, you know, almost becomes like a meta version, whereas it's in universe now, where this tale that we know so well is being used as a false, you know, false flag. Mm-hmm. And when really just, you know, that's the nice creamy, you know, icing, but yeah. underneath it's about as horrible as you can imagine. I mean, imagine, you don't even stop there, because you take, you know, all these fairy tales are always these wonderful balls, right? These beautiful balls, and all the girls are dressed up, and the Prince Charmings, right? Literally. And all these other things are happening. You turn the ball into basically a broodmare auction, And then that's not even enough. You turn it into a reaping.
Yes.
So it's
that kind of sentiment that, that Sophia's, you know, discussing with her, you know, cellmate basically at one point. It is a reaping. It is a, you know, it is this very insidious, thing that's happening, but on its face, it's, you know, and there's an invitation, and the invitation is beautiful and it's exciting. And then you read the fine print and it's like, if you don't show up, we will come and get you and you will be sorry, you know? So it's not an invitation. It's, you know, it's like a very,
it's a warning.
And it's out in the open. People can see it. They can read it. They know about it, but they follow along anyway. And that is something that feels very timely, right? Like you see the facts right there, but you choose to believe something else.
And that's a remarkable scene. And this is how much, and I mean, it doesn't happen overnight. I know you use the boiling frog fable, mm-hmm. but it took, you know, 200 years almost, right? The kings to put this into place. We won't get too spoilery with the end. We'll maybe leave the exact details of the end for the reader, but it took a long time for this type of oppression to sort of sink in. And so much that, like, you can picture a scene, you can like picture the ball, it's for 1 second, and you have, you know, dozens and dozens of these teenage girls dressed up to the nines, mm-hmm. and like some of them are crying, some of them are mm-hmm. shaking, some of them are like are jumpy, like I'm sure makeup is running, like it's a horrifying scene. And all the men are just, and the, I mean the fathers, some of them when they sent them away are not super stoked about it, but you know, you have this beautiful ball and it's a room full of like completely distraught girls, and all the men are like, man, this is great, and they're just like trying to buy two of them, and it's like,
Yeah, I mean, and it feels very, you know, it feels kind of extreme, right? But I just feel like I've been in so many situations in my own life where I'm looking around and I'm saying like, okay, y'all see what's happening, right? Nobody's mm-hmm. gonna like say anything. No one's gonna speak up, and they don't. It's really not that extreme, you know?
No, for sure. I think too, I wonder if they're like, you know, this sort of really dances on that line of how dark can it get? And it's a YA novel, so there's only so far you can go for sure. But like, I mean, this could easily be, you know, like a really hardcore, like I said, you know, just for lack of a better comparison right now, or doesn't need to be compared necessarily, but Handmaid's Tale, right? Or
right.
Handmaid's Tale. Like it could get really dark here. But you didn't. You go right up to the edge, I think, but you do get into some weird stuff for sure. Especially when we get into Amina and the fairy godmother, and we get into some necromancy and all sorts of stuff and, you know, divinations and stuff. And this is kind of spoilery, but you know, we do get a bit of Cinderella in this book, and that whole mm-hmm. scene is incredible too. And the reason I bring up just that, I want to talk about Amina for a little bit, the fairy godmother. Mm-hmm. And so again, you know, amidst all this horrible things, you know, love is very much at the center of it. And one of the things that Amina, it's funny when you read the book and then you go back and reread it, and then you try and look for all the times Amina was lying or telling the truth. Mm-hmm. And I find that her truths, when she does speak them, are profound in a way. And she has a really great line about love, you know, making you do, she says that's what love is supposed to do, right? It makes you do things you wouldn't normally do.
Right.
And, you know, she's definitely talking to Sophia and Constance at that point. And this book is full of great, wonderful little, you know, flirtatious romantic moments between Sophia and Constance, but it's not like overly saccharine.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Are you conscious of that?
Yeah. I mean, my main thing with, you know, the romance piece of it I really wanted to see Sophia be
adored,
desired. I wanted her to have that kind of, you know, those butterflies and those you know, that feeling of being, you know, wanted. And because I think sometimes we don't, you know, as Black women, we don't feel like we don't get to see ourselves in that light all the time. Mm-hmm. And so that was very important to me because I wanted to show her being, you know, being adored by this other girl. And that, you know, and I think that's in contrast to what she has with Aaron, which, you know, for me, it was very difficult to write Aaron's character because Aaron to me is not a bad person. She is a person who this place, this kingdom, it has left its mark on her. And so she's, you know, she kind of represents what it's like to be, you know, closeted. She is, you know, she cares for Sophia, but she cannot risk her safety. She's not at a point in her life where she's willing to kind of risk it all. And it's because she needs to be safe. That is her, you know, and I can't blame her for feeling like that. But then on the other hand, you have Constance who gives zero Fs about, you know, risk. She adores Sophia and is kind of willing to let it all just kind of be out there in the open. And Sophia does not, she hasn't had that before. And so it's very appealing to her, but there's this genuine kind of concern for her safety and her well-being on Constance's part. And so it, you know, the romance aspect of it is, you know, I wanted to show, you know, this girl being taken care of, being cared for in a way that felt sweet, that felt meaningful without it being, you know, she's 16. So,
right.
You know,
yeah, of course. Yeah.
You know, no,
for
I,
sure.
I just,
sweet, sweet's yeah. a great word. And there's so many times where like, really so many of those parts were my favorite parts in the book. And I couldn't, like, you could see them. Like, I think at one point I was reading and I was like, would you guys just set up camp already?
Yeah.
because you want those soft, quiet moments between the two of them. Right. Because at that point you love Sophia so much and you want the best for her and you can kind of see where this is going a little bit. And you're like, and again, yeah, you just want her to be adored. You want someone to treat her well. And when you get the impression that Constance is going to be that person in her life, you get addicted to it. You want more of it.
Yeah.
And just so many great moments, like, you know, the line about how she almost steers the cart into the ditch.
Yeah.
all these little things that add up to just a beautiful, beautiful love story. And I thought you did such a great job with it, you know.
Oh, thank you.
gave us just enough and, you know, left room for tons more, obviously.
Yeah.
And the Aaron part, yeah, to your point, Aaron is not a villain. There's none of that at all. I mean, it's, you know, this is at the cusp of great change, and she's going to be, unfortunately, one of the last victims of the old rule, right?
Yeah.
The old way of doing things. So,
yeah.
But just only because you brought her up, actually, she's sort of, you know, they have their last encounter at Aaron's, I guess, it's Edward's house because he's the man, but, and then we don't see her again, but we know the brothers do get some reprimands for, you know, the acts they've done. Is there, you know, because we're at this moment of change, is there any happy ending for Aaron? Like, what did you think in your mind?
So for me, it's, you know, Aaron is okay and she is going to be okay, but she's because of what's been done to her, because of, you know, the abuse that she has suffered, because she just really took, you know, the brunt of every terrible thing that is happening in this kingdom. And she never had someone, you know, she didn't have a grandmother to tell her that it was going to be okay. She didn't have, she had Sophia, but Sophia is so opposite to her, you know, personality wise, and she just couldn't see it. But I think that Aaron, you know, will get a happy ending. But it's going to take her a little bit longer to get there. And I think that that's probably true for a lot of us,
right,
who've been kind of impacted by society's expectations of who we should be. When things change, you know, it's kind of, it's hard sometimes. Even when the change is beneficial to you, it can be hard to change. So So yeah, I love Aaron, and I have a lot of love for that character, and I do, and even Sophia, you know, wants what's good for her. She wants her to be okay. She wants her to be safe, no matter what.
Right.
So yeah.
And it's, yeah, and that was, you know, the one scene where she tells Constance that she's going to go see Aaron one more time. It's just like, ugh.
Yeah.
So yeah, so very, very much the story of Cinderella that we know is an in-universe tale that's in your book, in your story. And so, and it's written so well, like this concept that you've come up with is so great. You know, I watched Cinderella just last night. I was up late. So I'm like, you know what, let's watch Cinderella. And yeah. Like, it's like, I'm cynical now when I watch it, and right, because you've changed it. You've changed it for me and everybody else who reads this. You know, it's now a tool that the king uses to manipulate and oppress and inflict you know, horrific things on people. For so in reality, that's not in your universe. That's not what really happened. That's not the truth. And one of the one of the great things I love that you did is you related to Constance. You made Cinderella's stepfamily heroes.
Yes.
Not the villains.
Right.
And so what was your, you know, talk through that process of, like, you know, when you decided that you were going to flip this tale on its head a little bit, sort of, who, you know, the villains are heroes and the heroes are villains. What was your sort of approach to that? Was like, did you want to dismantle everything? Cause the book could have been, this book could have been 1,000 pages, right? There's only so many things you could do.
Yeah, I wanted to focus on the villainous women of the story, of the version of Cinderella that most of us are familiar with. And even the older versions seem to always kind of incorporate a villainous stepmother, stepsister, stepsibling, somewhere in there. And so that was a part of the story that always kind of bothered me, because I just have so many... you know, people who are family, even though we're not related by blood. And, you know, usually when I hear a story about, you know, villainous women, I wonder who's telling the story. And so I knew that would be an aspect of Cinderella that I wanted to deconstruct. And I also wanted to highlight the Cinderella story itself in its original, well, not original, but in its kind of like Disney version of Cinderella. I wanted that to be in the story because I wanted to be able to compare and contrast what happens in this fictional kind of propaganda-like story with what actually happened, to show how, you know, a lie told over and over and over again, it has... In this society, it's become the truth. This is what people believe took place. And so I think that also feels very timely for right now. But yeah, it was definitely the villainous women that kind of, I was like, I have to tackle that, because how do you have these women who are, you know, so angry and so resentful towards Cinderella when she's a little girl? I know that happens. Families can be very complicated. Villainous women exist. But sure. For this purpose, for this story, I wanted to address that and to kind of tackle that aspect of the story.
And for anybody listening, who, you don't hate men, for the record, right?
No. Some men.
Don't even answer that.
No.
Don't even answer. Don't even answer that. It's just like, there's just people out there are going to think that. You might even think some of that, but ridiculous.
Yeah.
But,
if I am talking about all of these terrible men and you're not one of them, then I am not talking to you.
Everyone, that's listen. It. All right, good. Yeah. You got it out. There you go. Yeah, so much of this is controlling the information, access to information, controlling the information. And so one of the things you use in the book to lift the veil on you know, this 200 years of lies is Constance carries around this book of fairy tales. And it not only has sort of like the true account of what happened to Cinderella, but it also has a bunch of other tales in it as well. And you reference them, not only Snow White, but, you know, a couple of Brothers Grimm tales. Mm-hmm. So it's very much an in-universe, you know, canon thing going on here. Are you secretly, is this a backdoor to your own MCU? Like, what do you, is this, are you going to destroy all of our fairy tales?
Yes, good. I am. No, good. No, good. I would like to revisit some of those stories that were mentioned there at some point. That would be great. Yeah. I don't know how exactly I'm going to do that yet, but right. I'm definitely picking up some things.
Okay. Yeah. I'm very happy to hear that, because when that section comes up and you're reading all these things and I'm like, oh, is she okay? I hope
yeah.
so. I would be very happy, Kaylin, if you did that. That would be fantastic.
Yeah.
All right. So let's, a couple of things before we let you go here. Number one, and no offense to Manzi Jackson, but the UK cover is incredible.
It really is.
Isn't that fabulous? Yeah. Both covers are great. There's, don't get me wrong, for sure. But that UK one is, they make a nice side-by-side, actually. I'm probably going to pick up the UK one, too, just because.
Yeah, the cover art is fabulous.
You must have been super happy when you saw that.
Yeah.
Before we let you go again, let's have a little, because I've talked to some other writers and authors who, when they are writing their book, have somebody in mind, right? It's usually an actor, actress, famous, somebody famous. I don't know. They say it just helps. And do you do that at all? And if you do,
I do have like a board where I keep, you know, but most of the people that are on this like board where I build, you know, what characters look like and things like that, they're not really famous people, just because, you know, I'm looking for someone who like, so most of them are like, you know, people who are just on the internet, like models or, sure. or Instagram people or whatever, you know, just like people who have kind of like a look that is similar enough to what I'm looking for. So it's not really anybody famous, even though for Constance, I went to go see Star Wars. And the girl who's there with the freckles and the red hair, the black girl there,
that's who I said
her name?
Erin Kellyman. Yeah.
Yeah. So I have her on my board.
Okay. There you go. That's who I thought of right away.
That's great, because, you know, there's people who are like, oh, she has red hair and freckles, so this is definitely a white person. And I'm like, nah, look, there's, we come in all kinds, you know, we got red hair over here too.
You're mistaken. You mean the girl from Tangled, right? No, Erin Kellyman. She was in that Solo, A Star Wars movie. That's who I thought of right away when you, and the thing, I don't know why they would think anything else, because you said tawny skin. So why would they think?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's like that kind of.
They don't know what tawny means, I guess. But
yeah, so, it's kind of that that default. Yeah, it's kind of the white default that happens. Right. Yeah, if I don't tell you that this person is black, sometimes people will assume that they are.
There's
white.
other shades too, I guess, people need to understand. I thought of Erin Kellyman right away. So
yeah,
good job there. I have some ideas for the other characters, but it's just like, it's hard to. The Cinderella ones, we kind of have this idea in our head, right? Even though like you've gone a different route sort of with like, you know, having using Gabrielle and Elsa as the stepsisters, it's not the two we traditionally know, but who do you have for Sophia? Anybody I would know, any names? It's hard because we have a cover picture of her too, right? So
yeah, and so like the girl who's on my board is just, I mean, she looks very similar to the Sophia on the US cover, and I think she's like a hair model or something, like she's, you know,
sure.
But I saw, what did I see, it was, there was some show that was on Netflix, and it was, there's a girl who's on there, Lovey Simone, I think is her name.
Okay.
And I saw her on, something, I think it was on Netflix.
Okay.
And I was like, oh, she's that. Yeah. That's kind of who I think of when I think of, Sophia.
Okay. I'm looking at it right now. That's a great pick.
Yeah.
Perfect.
And
well, that's who it is then. Lovey Simone and Erin Kellyman are the two leads. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's Devin. And then, you know, for the other, you know, I just adore Toni Morrison so much. Mm-hmm. And so whenever I have like a grandmother figure, that's kind of who I think of when I think about, you know, Amina. And so, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Perfect. Yeah, that was fun. That's, I know some others do, authors do that. I don't know why. It helps them just sort of get in the mood, I guess. But
yeah, yeah.
Two things before I let you go. First of all, usually I usually start off with this, but I hope you're keeping safe down there in Texas. I know things. I'm in Toronto, so our numbers are nowhere near, you know, what you guys are experiencing. So how's everything going for you down there? Is this, because a lot of authors tend to be shut-ins anyways. Is this been a benefit? Have you gotten more work done this way, or is it just are you ready? You're ready to go?
Absolutely
outside?
Not. Yeah, no, because I'm here and I'm here with you know, my partner's also working from home and our kids are all home.
Right.
So it's kind of like, well, you know, there's six of us here in this house, and so it's been a challenge. Yeah. And in Texas. Yeah, it's kind of a hotbed. I'm in San Antonio. We are staying inside and we are continuing to wear masks and not go out unless we absolutely have to. Other people are not. And so the cases have kind of skyrocketed, but, right. We're just trying to take things one day at a time.
Sure. Has it sort of infringed on your writing space though? Like, what's your writing setup normally like?
Yeah, I mean, I have like a corner in my, like in my bedroom that is kind of like has my desk and my bookshelves. And so, and my door has a lock. So I just come in here and I'm just like, let me just take a minute and go in here but you know, I can still hear my kids are running around and they decide that they want to learn to like tap dance and play the recorder all at the same time while I'm trying to write. So it's a lot.
Well, good luck.
I don't see it
going away anytime soon. Not in your state. I know some states are better than others, but your state seems to have, that second wave is coming back.
Yeah, it's here.
Yeah. It's too bad.
And
so one of the, you kind of sort of hinted at it. Is there anything you're allowed to talk about for what you're working on next or anything coming out?
I can't say too much, but I do have a book, that's coming out next year. It is a YA fantasy, and it is, I like to say, if you like, Little Shop of Horrors, and if you like The Secret Garden, and if you, you know, like Greek mythology, with an all black queer cast, then this is going to be right up your alley. So,
that's a lot. Yeah. Even just Greek mythology with Little Shop of Horrors.
Oh, it's going to be great. Yeah,
that sounds great. You can sign me up for that one for sure. Yeah. I'm into that. That everything you described, and if what you did with Cinderella's Dead is any indication of what that book is going to go, what direction that book's going to go in, then I think we're all going to consider ourselves lucky that you are so busy writing books, because I can't say enough about this book. I love it. I've read it a couple of times.
Oh, yay.
Front to back, and then certain and then certain sections several times.
Yeah.
I really think it's great, Kaylin. Congratulations. Oh,
thank you so much. Thank you so much.
The buzz is true, people. So it's for sale now. Where I like to ask people, yes. where would you prefer people buy Cinderella's Dead?
Ultimately
anywhere, but
yeah, it's available anywhere. But like, if you could please support your local indie bookstore, that would be great. And I, you know, one of my favorite indies. There's two. There's Loyalty Bookstore in DC, okay. And there is Book People in Austin. If you and they have signed book plates there with those orders. So if you want a signed copy, you can go there. Yeah. And so, support your indie bookstores, because they are the lifeblood of publishing.
It's always important, but it's more important now than ever.
Yes, now more than ever.
We don't want to give any more money to that weird bald guy.
Yeah, no, he has enough.
He's scary. Enough. Yeah. He could be a villain in a book.
Yeah. Oh, he is.
He already is. Yeah. He scares me. Kaylin, I can't thank you enough. Please continue to be safe down in Texas. You don't want to be outside now anyways. It's too hot, right?
Yeah. No. Oh, no. It's 100 and something degrees out.
Yeah.
Nope.
So please be safe. Thank you so much for Cinderella's Dead. It's fantastic. And
thank you so much.
I wish you nothing but continued success.
There you have it. Another episode of Everything is Canon all wrapped up. Huge thanks to Kaylin for speaking with me at a great time, and I truly love this book. I can't wait for everyone to read it. Like she mentioned, make sure you check out loyaltybookstores.com or bookpeople.com to order a signed copy of Cinderella is Dead right now. Also, make sure you head over to kaylinbaron.com to learn more about Kaylin, find out what she's working on, and where you can see or listen to her next. As always, be sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you choose to listen. Head on over to cinelinks.com for the latest movie, TV, books, and gaming news. Be safe out there. Bye for now.
Our time has come.